Oh, is it? Okay, well, let's get started. I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. We do have a quorum present. We're starting. Everybody, please quiet down. Before we get to our agenda, just a few things that you've heard me repeat in this committee. Everyone here today must be seated when they're in the hearing room. No standing or sitting in the walkways or aisles. If you need any assistance, please ask our staff. Signs aren't permitted in the hearing room or at the testifiers table. Need to be left outside. Clapping, other disruptions are not allowed. All testifiers who have signed up in advance have been provided with a time limit for testimony in advance. Please adhere to these limits or you may be cut off. And if you're a member of a public choosing to testify, you'll also be provided with a time limit. We do this just because we have a lot of bills and a lot of amendments today, and we want to make sure that we have time for member discussion and voting on our bills. We first have to approve the minutes for March 12, 2024. Representative Mueller, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 12, 2024?
I would move that we would approve the minutes from our last meeting.
All right. Representative Mueller moves approval of the minutes for March 12, 2024. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for March 12, 2024 are approved. The first bill on the calendar today is House File 3640. It's a representative, what is it? Oh, 3650. It's a Representative Kozlowski bill. I will move that House File 3650 be placed on the general register, and I believe Representative Kozlowski, you have the DE1 amendment, and I will also move the DE1 amendment. Would you please speak to your DE1, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair and members, and it's great to be here in what feels like a star-studded room. This A1 author's amendment just clarifies that the Grand Portage Band, getting the bill into shape, that we're not seeking an additional appropriation, but that we're just giving them latitude to be able to buy equipment needed for Coast Guard boats, which have already been purchased.
Thank you very much. We certainly approve if a new appropriation is not being included in your bill. So the DE1 amendment is before us. Any discussion to the DE1? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The DE1 amendment is adopted. And Representative Kozlowski, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair. And yes, that is absolutely correct. Thanks to Representative Jamie Becker Finn and to this committee, we already passed and brought forward the appropriation for the Grand Portage Tribal Coast Guard program. And as I mentioned, this is just expanding the eligible uses for how those funds can be expended. And last year, if you recall, the Coast Guard service went away, and so Grand Portage needed to purchase these boats for themselves and then Cook County for tribal members, Native folks, but also non-Native folks who may be visiting or who live on the North Shore as well. And we know also that tribes are very resourceful folks. And so with the funding that was purchased last year or appropriated with $3 million, it came in under estimated value, and they were actually able to purchase 4 boats, 2 for Grand Portage and then 2 for Cook County. And this time they're looking to be able to expand to use that for boat equipment, personnel, patrolling, and other boat-related items. So happy to take any questions. I do not have a testifier today, but that is the purpose of this bill, is to just make sure that they can use the remaining funds. The 4 boats cost $1.8 million, and then they have the $1.2 remaining.
Great. Thank you. And I believe you had somebody here just to answer questions. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on the bill? Not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion. Chair Becker Finn.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Representative Kozlowski. And just wanted to thank Grand Portage for being resourceful and finding a way to get what they needed and still have this additional funds available. I think it makes sense for them to make sure that they're fully outfitting the equipment that they purchased so that they can keep people safe on the North Shore. So thank you for bringing this forward.
And I think all of us remember the testimony last year about tourists in their kayaks on Lake Superior needing help. So we appreciate the good work that they do. Other member discussion? Lee Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Kozlowski, so we've got a one-time appropriation of $3 million. Is there going to be an appropriation request going forward with this? You anticipate that, or are they going to come up with their own funding in the next biennium?
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair and Representative, for the question. In terms of ongoing funding, that is not something that has been discussed at this time, and with those additional funds being able to maintain and to outfit the boats, I don't anticipate that at the time, but I'd be certainly happy to find out and let you know. I think this bill is being laid over, so we would be able to get back to you on that.
Yeah, it is going to the general register, but at least this bill, as it is now, it's not appropriating any additional funds.
Thank you, Chair.
All right, any further discussion? Closing comments, Representative Kozlowski.
All right, well, I just want to say a big miigwech again for the funding and for the opportunity for the band to be able to serve the North Shore and to make sure that these funds are open to do what they need. So good bill, thank you, and ask for your support.
All right, I'll renew the motion that House File 3650 as amended be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thanks so much. Next up, we have House File 4641. It's Representative Long's bill. I will move that House File 4641 be placed on the general register. I also will move the A1 amendment. Any comments, Representative Long, to the A1 amendment?
Just to get the bill in the shape I'd like it.
All right. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Your bill is now before us. Majority Leader Long, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. So this is a cleanup bill for the Clean Slate Act that we enacted last year, which provides for second chances for individuals who were convicted of low-level crimes and have had a crime-free waiting period and are ready to get their lives back on track. And we are trying to clarify and clean up a few things from last year's bill, four in particular. The first is that we clarify that the offense of reckless driving resulting in great bodily harm or death will be ineligible for automatic expungement. It was made eligible in the last bill, but the intent was for it to be eligible for petition-based expungement and not automatic expungement. So we wanted to clarify that. The second is that due to a drafting error, third-degree burglary was included as eligible for automatic expungement rather than petition-based expungement in last year's bill. And with stakeholder consensus, we took most of burglary 3 off the automatic list, but carved out a very small exception for trespass burglaries. For trespass burglaries, the violation of the trespass order is what puts them in felony burglary territory, but the behavior involved is minor. And so trespass burglaries are only a small portion of the burglary 3s that counties see, and this was amenable to all of the stakeholders. And then the third is that we make clear that the waiting period before a person can petition for expungement is 4 years for certain cases involving a stay of imposition. And this was for consistency's sake. In the bill, if you received a stay of imposition for certain crimes that were charged as felonies in last year's law, you would have wait for 5 years before petitioning for expungement. But someone charged and convicted for the same felony crime would only have to wait for 4 years. So this change puts the stay of imposition in alignment with felonies on the 4-year waiting list period. And the fourth is we clarify that certain offenses relating to offering a forged check will be eligible for expenses, and we are having the forged check have the same expungement eligibility as check forgery for $2,500 or less. So those are the four cleanup provisions. We have the same broad coalition and support that supported the bill last year, including the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, Board of Public Defense, Justice Action Network, Legal Aid, MACDL, and others, and have Jorge Saavedra with Ramsey County here for any technical questions that I can't answer.
All right, so you're just here for questions, Mr. Saavedra? All right.
That's right, Chair Mueller. Thank you.
All right, great. So we'll see if there are any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill. And I'm not seeing any, so we will move on to member discussion. Representative Tapke.
Thank you very much, Chair Mueller, and Majority Leader Long for bringing specifically lines 216 and 217 for the person causing great bodily harm or death due to reckless driving. And I think that's a really important one to have in here. And we talked about this a little bit this summer. And we've been working from my transportation side of things with folks on reckless driving and more work that can be done around this. And I think this is a very good provision to have clarified in this bill. So thanks for bringing that forward. Thank you, Representative.
Further member discussion? All right. I am not seeing any. So any closing comments, Majority Leader Long?
No, Madam Chair. Would appreciate the committee's support.
All right, I'll renew the motion that House File 4641 as amended be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thanks. Next up, we have Representative Curran. This is House File 4326. And I believe that, Representative Curran, your motion is that House File 4326 be placed on the general register.
Yes, Chair, that is my motion. Thank you.
All right. And I also see that you have the A5 amendment. Would you like to move the A5 amendment and let us know what it does?
Yes, I move the A5 amendment, which it adds retired judges and current employees of the Office of Administrative Hearings, Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals, and Tax Court. This was just in the process of making the bill better. We realized that there are some judges that might be targeted specifically because of the work they do, and we want to make sure they're included. So I ask for member support.
All right. Any discussion to the A5 amendment? All those in favor of the A5 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the A5 amendment is adopted. We do have other amendments, but we'll move on to those after we take testimony. And your bill as amended is before us. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. Thank you for hearing House File 4326 today. The safety of Minnesota's judges, court staff, and members of their households are put at risk by dissemination and perpetual internet access of home addresses and personal information. The bill before us, as amended, dubbed the Judicial and Court Staff Safety and Privacy Act, will help alleviate safety concerns. This legislation is a collective effort by our Minnesota judicial branch. It's a legislative priority adopted for action this session by the Judicial Council and the Minnesota District Judges Association. The bill does several things, and keeping it within the purview of today's committee in public safety, I would note that we are looking at the sections that create a misdemeanor penalty for knowingly publishing the personal information of a judicial official with intent to threaten, intimidate, harass, or physically injure. And should that intent to harm cause bodily harm, that would lead to a felony. And that's what's before us today in our committee. And I'll turn it over to testifiers for further details.
All right. And I believe that your first testifier is Judge John Guthman. Welcome to the committee, Your Honor. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
All right, thank you. Good morning, Chair Mueller and committee members. My name is John Guthman. I'm a district court judge serving in the 2nd Judicial District, which is Ramsey County. I've been on the bench since 2008. I'm the former chief judge of the 2nd Judicial District, and I served on the Minnesota Judicial Council for 4 years. I should note that I'm also a constituent of Representative David Pinto, who's appeared in front of me in Ramsey County on many occasions. It's my privilege to speak to you today in two capacities. First, I'm a member of the Minnesota District Judges Association, which has over 300 trial court and appellate court members throughout Minnesota. I also serve as a member of the Minnesota Legislative Advisory Work Group, which reports to Judicial Council and recommends the legislative agenda each year. Both the MDJA and the Judicial Council have made protection of judicial safety through passage of this bill a top legislative priority this year. I'd like to thank Chief Author Curran, who just described the key components of our legislation. My goal today is to share the importance of Section 4, the criminal penalty section, which is the focus of this committee's review. Section 4 is central to the purpose of our legislation. The specter of criminal penalties is necessary to deter people from threatening, intimidating, harassing, or physically injuring judicial officers. It operates in parallel with the other sections, which are also meant to prevent or deter the dissemination of the personal information of judicial officials while providing an avenue for removal of already disseminated personal information. Section 4 is consistent with other Minnesota criminal statutes that criminalize this kind of behavior. It contains not but one but two intent-related requirements. First, the actor must knowingly publish the personal information of a judicial official through publicly available publication, website, or media. An unknowing act cannot be prosecuted then. Second, the actor must publish with the specific intent to threaten, intimidate, harass, or physically injure. The conduct is punished as a misdemeanor, but if it causes bodily injury, it is punished as a felony. The requirements of knowing publication and intent to harm should eliminate any constitutional concerns about this law. It's not intended to criminalize any protected speech. Minnesota judges are not immune from the nationwide outbreak of violence and threats directed against judicial officers. These are occurring in our courthouses, at judges' personal residences, in the community, and they're directed at families, including our children. You have a one-page handout in your packets, which was provided to the committee. It outlines a survey we conducted earlier this year and demonstrates why your judicial branch is so concerned about their safety and why action on this legislation is important to protect the rule of law, preserve the independence of the judiciary, and protect the, and prevent the kind of tragedies that have occurred recently all over the country. So we are thankful for the leadership to get this bill in front of the legislature for action this year, and I'm happy to entertain any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. And I see that there are a couple other judges signed up as available for questions. Do you have any other testifiers? Okay. Anybody from the public wishing to testify? All right. Next, we're going to move to the A3 amendment. Who is offering the A3 amendment? Representative Hudson. There's feedback on this microphone today, so I don't know what's going on.
All right. I will start off keeping back. You let me know if I need to.
All right. Go. Please explain your A3 amendment.
So, first of all, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Curran. Very much appreciate what you're doing here and the necessity to do it as I see it. And I want to speak specifically to my amendment, but I feel like I need to provide a little bit of context of where I'm coming from with it. I very much appreciated the point that was made by Judge Guthman just now. Regarding the fact that this is not an encroachment in any way upon people's freedom of expression, freedom of speech. There is a very clear distinction in my mind between speech and conduct. And when you're engaged in conduct that intimidates, harasses, even just to my mind, impedes a person's ability to peacefully enjoy their own property, you're crossing a line that goes beyond speech. What this amendment does is it adds peace officers and prosecutors to the list of folks whose information would be protected under this. I think we've seen plenty of examples of how conduct that crosses that line from speech to intimidation and harassment has been utilized to try to impact prosecutorial decisions and put political pressure on the administration of justice in ways that are completely unacceptable. And I'm hopeful that we'll be able to amend this bill today in order to address that. Thank you.
All right, Representative Curran to the amendment.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Hudson, for the amendment. I certainly appreciate the movement to protect information for folks who are in vulnerable situations where they might be attacked, where that information might be shared and used against them. Today before us is a bill, again, that was brought forward from judicial officials with supporting data. In our previous committee stop, we did discuss whether the scope of this is already too large. I know there was concern from your side specifically on that, of how far is this going to go. But I am open to that conversation. This is a starting place, and I do think there is value in opening this up to potentially other government positions, not just limited to law enforcement officials, but we could be at some point talking about elected officials, because I know there are folks in this room too who have had some very significant threats and had their personal information disseminated with the intent to cause threat to ourselves or our family members. So I see that as a serious concern and appreciate where you're coming from. I'm going to encourage members to vote no on this amendment today, knowing that this is a starting place with the data that we have specifically regarding judicial officials, knowing that we'll start somewhere, and when we know better, we do better, and we'll continue to work on this in the future.
Further discussion to the A3? Novotny?
Request a roll call, Chair.
Okay, roll call has been requested. Any further discussion? Representative Hudson, closing remarks.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Curran. Listen, if there's anybody on my side who's arguing that we shouldn't be protecting people's data, let me know. I'll have a little conversation with them, because I tend to agree with you that the scope of this could and should properly be significantly larger than it is. I think we're about to hear another amendment along those lines. But, you know, I would just point people to, you know, we had protests outside a police chief's home after the death of Amir Locke. We had a protest of a county attorney, Washington County attorney, outside of a Stillwater home in relation to the Dante Wright case. And, of course, there's the the ever so famous case of what happened in Hugo at the height of the George Floyd backlash. And so we've seen plenty of examples of people, officials being targeted in ways that certainly cross that line from speech into conduct that intimidates and harasses. And so I hope that we can work to move this forward. And I think my amendment would be a good start. So I would encourage members to vote yes.
Representative Hudson moves the A3 amendment. A roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mueller.
No.
Chair Mueller votes no. Vice Chair Feist.
No.
Vice Chair Feist votes no. Lead Novotny.
Yes.
Lead Novotny votes yes. Representative Becker Finn.
No.
Representative Becker Finn votes no. Representative Curran.
No.
Representative Curran votes no. Representative Engen.
Yes.
Representative Engen votes yes. Representative Frazier.
No.
Representative Frazier votes no. Representative Grossel.
Yes.
Representative Grossel votes yes. Representative Hollins.
No.
Representative Hollins votes no. Representative Hudson.
Yes.
Representative Hudson votes yes. Representative Hewitt.
No.
Representative Hewitt votes no. Representative Mueller.
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Mueller votes yes. Representative Pinto.
No.
Representative Pinto votes no. Representative Tapke.
No.
Representative Tapke votes no. Representative Witte.
Yes.
Representative Witte votes yes.
There being six ayes and nine nays, the motion does not prevail. Who will be offering the A4 amendment?
That'll be me, Chairman.
Lead Novotny, please explain the A4 amendment.
The A4 amendment makes everyone's personal contact information private. Why are we limiting this to just one group of people? People from many professions and walks of life are victims of doxing and other activities at their homes. There are many instances of someone who works at McDonald's or Walmart or some other personal business, or they've been involved in an incident that they have had doxing and they've had their personal information disseminated for purposes of intimidation. I want to be perfectly clear that this is in no way a slight or to diminish the threats that the judicial branch faces. When I first saw this bill, the first thought that came to my mind was rules for thee and not for me. And the other thought that came to mind was that there's a columnist for the St. Paul Pioneer Press, Joe Souchere, who writes about the third rail, how certain members of the ruling class have special rules. And this is the perfect example of a third rail, that there's certain groups that are untouchable, but everyone else is subject to different rules.
All right. I thought you were done.
I will wrap up. I just don't understand. We've all been subject to these threats, or the threat of them. I think about the driver of the fuel truck on the day of the George Floyd riots and the protest that he was put through, and do a Google search, all the legislators that have had the protesters at their houses, everyone is subject to this, whether they're in the legislature or they sit on the bench or they work at Walmart. I think everyone should have this protection, and for that reason, I encourage everyone to vote yes, and that'll be all. Thank you.
Representative Curran to the A4 amendment.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Lead Novotny. Again, appreciate where you're coming from. I think that, again, this bill is a starting place, and we need to see how this works before we work on major changes or expansion. I would just note for members that I am recommending a no vote, the concern here being that the exception in this amendment could negate a good portion of what we're intending to do with this bill. Again, working on this as a foundation, encouraging a no vote today, but willing to work on this in the future if we see that there are concerns after this bill passes. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And I just want to address the comments, too, because the judges came to us with this specific bill. And I know when they came last year, it just wasn't ready yet. More work needed to be done in the interim. They did that work. The other groups that were mentioned certainly can bring bills as well. And I don't know that we've seen that. I do know we did pass a bill last year. I thought we did. We're trying to get some information as well. And I think Chair Becker-Finn's going to speak to that. So I will call on Chair Becker-Finn.
Yeah, both. We were all sitting over here, thank you, Madam Chair, going, didn't we pass that? So I know Representative Pinto had also pulled it up. So in 609.5151 is already in statute. That is misdemeanor to disseminate personal information about law enforcement. So that's already in law. They're already protected. So we really don't need to do that because it's already in law. And then, you know, so I don't take two bites at the apple, Chair Mueller. We'll also just say, you know, I think what's unique, and as the Judiciary Chair will say, you know, the unique role that a judge plays in trust in our government and our system, and honestly, democracy, demands that we not have pressure put on them in a way where we have people holding things against them or using their data to try to force an outcome has implications much broader than just the individual because of the decisions they're making, having, you know, we're setting precedent, we're, you know, it goes broader than just the impact on the individual person. So it's kind of a philosophical thing to think about. And we did fully discuss this in the Judiciary Committee. So I think it makes a lot of sense to me that we would not want that undue pressure put on judges when we are counting on them to make decisions for the right reasons and not because there's undue pressure or threats or things like that happening to them, on top of the problem we have with, especially in rural areas, with folks wanting to be judges and having enough people who are willing to do that type of public service. If their families are now threatened, I think that actually harms our ability to continue to have the best people doing that work. So speaking against the A4 amendment, I also have constitutional concerns because the what you're weighing of what the pros and cons are different when you're talking about someone who makes those judicial decisions versus just any person who exists. I would be concerned about the First Amendment implications if we were to stop that in any way whatsoever. So please vote against the amendment and for the bill.
Further discussion to the A4? Chair Pinto.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just note it was Representative Frazier who gets the credit for pointing out, and I'm sorry that we didn't pull it together before that last roll call, but that it is currently against the law already to disseminate personal information about law enforcement connected to that prior vote, and appreciate him pointing that out, and then everything that Chair Becker-Finn said about the sanctity of how important it is. That's a bedrock of our system, our judiciary. Thank you.
Further discussion to the A4? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to be brief. I'm a little perplexed at what the First Amendment implications could be. I mean, I don't know that anybody has a First Amendment right to disseminate personal information about somebody for the purpose of intimidating or harassing them. And that's what this amendment would do, is expand that protection to literally everyone, which I think is entirely appropriate. Beyond that, you know, the previous amendment, we included prosecutors as well. They're obviously involved in making decisions that have broader impact than just their own individual selves. I'm hopeful that what Representative Curran said earlier does portend a broader conversation that we can have about extending these protections, and again, taking seriously that distinction between legitimate First Amendment speech, saying something, as opposed to engaging in conduct that has the intention of intimidating or harassing people. Thank you.
All right. Representative Novotny, closing remarks on your amendment?
Oh, yes.
All right. Representative Novotny moves the A4 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. All right. Next, we will move on to member discussion to the bill. Any member discussion to the bill itself? All right. Any closing remarks, Representative Curran?
Thank you, Chair. And again, thank you, members, for the discussion. So far, discussions in both committee stops have been really great. And again, this is a starting point. We know that we've got some data from the U.S. Marshals that the number of federal judges who received threats across the country rose by 50% last year, from 300 in 2022 to 457 in 2023. And we, you know, this bill is a starting place because we've got the data to back up that this is a vulnerable group for reasons that members have mentioned today. And I truly am happy to continue work on protecting folks as technology has advanced. This is becoming a more prevalent issue for people who need to keep their personal information private. So with that said, I ask for member support moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Curran renews the motion that House File 4326, as amended, be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. All right. Next, we'll move on to Representative Pinto's bill, House File 4387. Representative Pinto, I believe the motion is that House File 4387 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law.
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
All right. And members, I think what we're going to do with the amendments here is go to the A4 amendment. We'll have an explanation and a testifier, and then we'll move on to the other amendments. So, Representative Pinto, would you like to move and explain the A4 amendment, please?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I do move the A4 amendment. It's really just making some technical fixes to the underlying bill. And if it's okay with members, maybe we'll adopt that and then happy to explain the bill and move to the testifier.
All right. Any questions about the A4 amendment? All those in favor of the A4 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The A4 amendment is adopted. All right, then, Chair Pinto, if you'd like to explain your bill as amended, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this bill, House File 4387, was initiated when a friend of mine had challenges having an order for protection that she had sought and obtained, but then had a hard time having that be served. And that kind of uncovered a number of challenges in terms of making sure that when an order actually is issued, of course, it doesn't do a lot of good if the court order gets issued, but then it never is actually served on the respondent, the person who's been found that they should not have contact with the petitioner. And so what the bill does is has some requirements that service be executed, that the person's location be sought, the respondent is the name of the person the petition is issued, the order is issued against, and that there be kind of cooperation in the system to try to make that happen. So a number of fixes with that. I think that's probably all I need to note now. I'll simply say, as folks are aware, that I work as a prosecutor and kind of foundationally started that work specializing in domestic violence prosecution, so I've encountered these challenges along the way. And it's very frustrating when somebody goes to get an order issued, gets an order, the court says, yep, you deserve one, and then doesn't get served, and then we can't do anything at that point. So happy to turn to my testifier, and thank you, Chair.
All right, and I believe your testifier is Elsa Swenson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Mueller and members of the committee. My name is Elsa Swenson. I lead a community-based legal advocacy program at Missions, Inc. Programs, serving victims survivors of domestic abuse. I testify in support of House File 4387 because I've seen and believe in the power of protection orders to interrupt violence in our community. However, a protection order without enforcement is simply a piece of paper, and people who use violence know this and are emboldened when violations go unenforced. Many times, victims petitioning for a protective order are doing so at great risk to themselves and their families. The trauma of petitioning for a protective order is not worth living through if our legal system cannot properly respond to violations. Lack of proper service is one of the biggest reasons that violations are not or cannot be enforced. House File 4387 makes two important changes to how service of protection orders is effectuated. The first change comes from lessons that we learned the hard way during the COVID-19 pandemic. When protective order hearings went remote at the height of the 2020 lockdown, the usual practice of personally serving a respondent with a continuance order or an order following a hearing prior to them leaving the courthouse became impossible, and orders were sent to the Sheriff's Department for personal service. If violations occurred after the remote hearing, but before the respondent was personally served, law enforcement data showed the order as unserved and therefore could not enforce the order. A case I personally worked on took 3 months to serve the respondent following the remote evidentiary hearing, despite the respondent being present when the judge determined domestic abuse had occurred, and an order for protection would issue. My client's reports of violations went unanswered, and the power of the court was undermined, all because the respondent successfully avoided service of an order that he knew existed. Understandably, my client was frustrated and questioned the point of seeking an order for protection, spending hours preparing for a hearing, and reliving her trauma in front of her abuser and the court, when at the end of the day, there was no accountability for her abuser's unchanged behavior. House File 4387 allows for electronic or first-class mail in a situation where the respondent is present and aware that an order for protection is going to be issued, allowing the protection order to be fully enforceable immediately upon issuance following a remote hearing. Petitioners and respondents both overwhelmingly report preferring remote hearings. The proposed change does not decrease access to justice for the respondent or change their right to contest a protection order. It simply prevents them from having to be personally served by law enforcement more than once and closes a gap in the service process. The second change in House File 4387 clarifies the service process for respondents who are on supervision by probation or parole, while simultaneously easing the burden for survivors by increasing communication among system partners and not forcing petitioners to attempt to locate the person who has abused them in order to effectuate service. Survivors expect system players to communicate, and this change makes clear the duties of the system to work together. Additionally, I believe that providing probation agents with protection orders increases their ability to more holistically understand the life of the person that they're supervising and address the full scope of behavior change that's needed, ultimately resulting in greater public safety. Violence Free Minnesota's letter of support further outlines the benefits to this very practical solution. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on this issue, and I welcome your questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else from the public who wishes to testify? All right, I'm not seeing anybody. So we will move on to the other amendments at this point. Next, we will move to the A3 amendment. Chair Pinto, would you like to move and explain your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move the A3. So members, House File 4387 addresses, just about everything I can think of, almost everything relating to these protective orders and concerns there, except for one major gap, which relates to firearms and the surrender of firearms. This is something that Chair Mohler and I have worked on for many years trying to address because it's a challenge all around the country when an order is issued or someone's convicted of domestic violence, not allowed to have a firearm, supposed to turn that in. But we know that that often does not happen. And we want to make sure that, in fact, it does. And so the thinking is to have a task force to look at that issue. Unlike some other task forces, this is a clear task for that force to identify what can we do to make sure that surrender of firearms is actually happening, and in general to reduce the danger to our peace officers and other emergency responders when it comes to addressing incidents of domestic violence. And I know that is on all of our minds because of the recent and tragic deaths of the heroes in Burnsville. So members, what the amendment does is set up a task force to address that, and I'm very hopeful that we're going to have some very concrete suggestions and recommendations to fix this process. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And there's an A3 amendment to the A5. Who will be offering the A3 amendment?
The other way around.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, sorry about that. There's an A5 amendment to the A3 amendment, and it looks like, Lee Navati, you're offering the A5 amendment.
I am, Chair.
All right, please explain your amendment.
The A5 amendment focuses on the task force work, looking to more broadly expand the investigation into the domestic abuse laws, including looking at orders for protections, domestic assaults, harassment, and stalking. We need to focus not to be on the firearm, but the broader issue of keeping domestic violence victims safe from further harm. There are numerous ways an abuser can victimize domestic abuse victims. The A5 amendment requires the Task Force on Domestic Violence to make recommendations to the legislature next year more comprehensively on our domestic abuse violence laws. The amendment also brings a voice of an actual domestic violence victim into the conversation. We don't need the task force to look into the firearms piece of domestic violence related statutes. We just need the current laws to be enforced. And we have a bill for that. House File 699 requires that courts hold a compliance hearing within 10 days that the domestic violence offender proves that they have transferred the firearms. Representative Scott has requested a hearing on this bill from last year. Let's hear this bill and let's solve this problem rather than study it. I ask for your support.
Chair Pinto, to the A5 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I strongly oppose the A5, and I heard a contradiction in the comments, so we just need current laws enforced, and yet we need a new law. Members, there's a number of things that we need to have happen when it comes to the surrender of firearms. That may well include new laws. It may well include new procedures. It may well include training. There's a number of things, and the chair and I have been working on this for quite a while. Minnesota is a leader when it comes to domestic violence work. We have been for decades in all kinds of areas. This is a gap that is putting people's lives at risk. I'd like to ask members of the public to think. We know that there's a disparity of women in the U.S. losing their lives to guns at a higher rate than women in other developed countries. I wonder if you could just think to yourself as to what that difference is. You might think it's 5 times more likely or 10 times. It turns out 28 times more likely. Members, we need to have a focus on getting the firearm out of the situation. When the law says, this is enforcing a current law, the law says the abuser should not have a firearm, let's make sure we're actually figuring out how to make that happen. As members, I'd ask you to vote it down, and Madam Chair, I would request a roll call on this amendment.
All right, a roll call has been requested. Discussion to the A5 amendment. Chair Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and would encourage members to vote against the A5 amendment to the amendment. So I was actually working at the Domestic Abuse Service Center when we initially passed the law that said that your firearms would be taken away, you know, that you didn't have access to them when an OFP was issued. And we knew, legislators knew, we all knew, the community, I see like the advocates nodding their heads, like we knew that we needed to figure this stuff out. And so I think it's incredibly important that we figure out the process. And so just so folks think it through, we actually had someone who knew they were ordered to not have their firearms, but there isn't a process, a uniform process in every county of how you do that. So we actually had somebody who brought their firearms into the government center because they were like, okay, I'm supposed to turn these in. Nobody told me a process of how to do that. Like, here they are, which is the worst thing, that, you know, to have an abuser then bringing a firearm into the domestic abuse center is entirely problematic. And so it was a problem that we didn't figure this out initially when this passed. And so I am so glad that we are going to take affirmative steps, because, you know, there are also questions about where would they be stored when the order is lifted? How do you get them back? Which I assume folks on the other side would be interested in that. You know, it's property that belongs to somebody. Counties don't have the funds to figure out how to store them safely and how to, you know, have a whole process for that. So I think it's critical that we address this, and removing firearms from what this task force would be working on is entirely counterproductive. So it's a good underlying amendment. We should vote down the amendment to the amendment. Thank you.
All right, further member discussion to the A5 amendment? All right.
Maybe actually, Madam.
Oh, go ahead, Chair Pinto.
Just real briefly, I'll just note, I have been in touch with law enforcement groups who've confirmed that this issue of firearm surrender is and I think this hopefully would be obvious to all of us, is a major challenge and a major issue that we need to be addressing. And so simply want to note that this is a significant thing we need to figure out. And so the task force, without this secondary amendment, the task force really needs to be focused on that. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, thank you. And I know that you have several law enforcement groups involved in the task force in your amendment. So closing remarks, Lead Novotny.
Chair Mueller, I don't know, maybe I need to speak more clearly. At no point did I mention that looking into the firearms shouldn't be said. At no point did I say that this isn't a problem. I've said it before, I'll say it again. I was running the evidence room where I worked when we first started having guns surrendered as part of the domestic abuse orders. Guns may have been brought to the facilities, Chair Becker-Finn, because at that time, when it first came out, that's where they had to surrender them to. It was later amended that they could surrender them to a family member or a licensed firearm dealer. So I could see where a person would bring them to the court, because that's where we were. And that was the situation that they operated under to start with. Originally, the courts followed up on this. And then it just dropped off. And I don't know why. And we had this conversation last night, Representative Pinto, about we don't know why this was not done. We don't take away anyway the importance of someone who's under one of these orders having this enforced and them surrendering their guns. We agree. I don't know where that was apparently missed in what I said, and we are out in front of you. I don't want to take another year on a task force when we could hear the bill, we could get this included, and then that part of it would be taken care of, and we could use the task force to dive deeper into the issues. So I assume that any mischaracterization or misunderstanding of what I said was accidental, and I would have asked for the roll call, Mr. Pinto, or Representative Pinto, but that would have been my call. If you read the amendment and you read the bill that we wish could get a hearing and be included as part of the omnibus bill, we wouldn't be having this discussion. Thank you, Chair.
A roll call has been requested, and the clerk will take the roll on the A5 amendment.
Chair Mueller.
No.
Chair Mueller votes no. Vice Chair Feist.
No.
Vice Chair Feist votes no. Lead Novotny.
Yes.
Lead Novotny votes yes. Representative Becker Finn.
No.
Representative Becker Finn votes no. Representative Curran.
No.
Representative Curran votes no. Representative Engen.
Yes.
Representative Engen votes yes. Representative Frazier.
No.
Representative Frazier votes no. Representative Grossel.
Yes.
Representative Grossel votes yes. Representative Hollins.
No.
Representative Hollins votes no. Representative Hudson.
Yes.
Representative Hudson votes yes. Representative Hewitt.
No.
Representative Hewitt votes no. Representative Mueller.
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Mueller votes yes. Representative Pinto.
No.
Representative Pinto votes no. Representative Tabke.
No.
Representative Tabke votes no. Representative Whitty.
Yes.
Representative Whitty votes yes. 6 ayes.
There being 6 ayes and 9 nays, the motion does not prevail. All right, now we're back to the underlying A3 amendment. Any discussion to the A3 amendment itself? All right, nothing further from you, Chair Pinto, on that? All right. All those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The A3 amendment is adopted. All right, now we'll move on to member discussion of the bill as amended. Any further discussion to the bill as amended? Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Representative Pinto, for bringing this bill forward. When I was at Burnsville, we've had to make a lot of these attempts. And unfortunately, it wasn't, like you said, they tried to avoid and it was never an easy thing. I will tell you, Ring cameras have made it even more difficult. But also at Burnsville, we had a domestic abuse response team that we tried to work and worked hard in the community. Do you know if these orders are then put on, delivered to the state and put on their registration? So if they're driving, can law enforcement make those stops?
Chair Pinto?
You know, Madam Chair and Representative Whitty, I don't know the answer. I don't think so, but I'm not sure if there's somebody else who may have knowledge about that. My testifiers.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Ms. Vinson. Yeah.
I do believe they do. It gets passed through the BCA when the order is issued upon service.
I think that will be helpful because that could obviously take some of the pressure away, but it gets back to what we've been talking about, reducing law enforcement pretense stops. So, but like I said, if they're driving the vehicle, you get them out on the street when they're not expecting it, and that order pops up when you're, I think that's the maybe a solution to get it over to the BCA quicker so it's out there. I will tell you, it's very frustrating because when these orders come, we know they can be very helpful, and it could possibly be, you know, when we talk about, you know, hours, days, or whatever from incidents happening, the quicker we can get that information out to law enforcement, I think the quicker we can probably serve some of these people as they're going back and forth to work or other places. So thank you.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and just wanted to sort of connect the dots on why the personal service and proof of service is so important, because the first element when you're trying to prove a case and looking at prosecuting a case is whether you can prove that they knew about the order, and personal service and proof of service is the easiest way to do that. I did sometimes bring cases where I'm like, they were in the hearing, they knew, or, you know, they appeared by phone. But when a judge looks at that, it makes it that much harder to prove the case, even though we all know he knew he wasn't supposed to be at her house. Just having that proof of service and having some other options here so that it can be officially served and in the system as served is incredibly important. So I think this just updates with the way courts operate now and makes a lot of sense. So thank you for bringing this forward. Thank
you. Any further member discussion?
Sure.
Oh, Lee Novotny.
Yeah, I just, it's a good bill, Representative Pinto. As I said last night, I hope to keep working with you on this. There's a couple of things I think that would really make it more effective and dial it in. And before this comes back to the floor, I hope we can fix that. Thank you.
Closing remarks, Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks, Representative Monty. Yeah, I mean, this is very much intended to be, including the task force, it's intended to be like addressing concrete problems that will keep people safer, and I'd urge that includes the issue of firearm surrender as well. And so look forward to continue work with you. Thank you, Chair, and thanks to members.
Representative Pinto renews the motion that House File 4387, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Our next bill is House File 2400. It's a Representative Frazier bill. And I believe, Representative Frazier, that your motion is that House File 2400 be placed on the General Register. I'll give you a minute to get to the table.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
All right. And Representative Frazier, I believe you also have an A2 amendment. Would you like to move the A2 amendment and explain the A2 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. The A2 amendment, it increases the number of days that allowed for a response to the appellate process from 20 days to 45 days. And that was language worked on with the County Attorneys Associations to make sure that they were okay with this.
Thank you. Any discussion to the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Frazier, your bill is before us as amended. Please explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members, leads, Vice Chair. House File 2400 is a bill that will revise the language governing exception to the 2-year statute of limitations in Minnesota Statute 590.01. However, this bill is not just about legal technicalities. It is about ensuring that individuals who have been wrongfully convicted have a chance at justice. As it stands, our current law makes Minnesota one of the most restrictive jurisdictions in the nation and the most restrictive in the Midwest when an individual is seeking to bring forth post-conviction claims based on newly discovered evidence. The requirement that this evidence must demonstrate their innocence by a clear and convincing standard is simply unreasonable. Many cases do not lend themselves to this type of proof, and as a result, people with serious claims are kept in prison and out of the court due to a procedural technicality that has nothing to do with the merits of the case. This bill seeks to rectify this by striking a requirement of this high standard. Instead, if an individual has truly new evidence that supports a legal valid claim for relief, they deserve their day in court. This change would bring Minnesota law more in line with other jurisdictions and ensure that individuals with meritorious claims are not unjustly kept out of court. The case of Marvin Haynes serves as a poignant example of why this legislation is so crucial. Marvin was wrongfully convicted and spent nearly 20 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. It was only through the waiver of the statute of limitations by the Hennepin County Attorney's Office that he was able to have his case reconsidered. We cannot rely on such waivers to ensure justice is served. We need a more reasonable standard in place. And I hope we all can support House File 2400 to allow for that more reasonable standard. Let us ensure that individuals like Marvin Haynes have their shot at justice and are not kept out of court due to procedural technicalities. I'll yield to my testifier.
All right. Welcome back to the committee. Andrew Marquardt, please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mueller and members of the committee. My name is Andrew Marquardt. I'm a managing attorney at Great North Innocence Project. We represent individuals who've been wrongfully convicted of crimes and work to promote public policies that prevent and help remedy wrongful convictions. And the reason our organization exists is that sometimes the system gets it wrong. Sometimes we put innocent people in prison, and we need to have procedures that allow us to fix those errors when they happen. That's what this bill is about. I'll keep my remarks brief because Representative Frazier summarized it well. But the problem is right now, If you're more than 2 years out, it is almost impossible in most cases to get back into court unless you have DNA, something of similarly dispositive. The standard just makes it exceedingly difficult. And in many cases, you just don't have that kind of evidence. And we're just talking about the standard for getting past the statute of limitations here, right? We're not talking about the standard for getting relief. We're talking about getting into court, not about going home. So this would give a more reasonable standard for getting over that procedural hurdle, and then you have a chance to make your case. You might win, you might lose. You got to prove your case, but at least you get a chance. And today, too many people are being denied that chance. People like our client, Marvin Haynes, and there are more people out there like him. So this will create a more reasonable standard. I hope you will support the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. And we had one member of the public sign up to testify, Hennepin County Attorney Mary Moriarty. Welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Moeller and committee members. My name is Mary Moriarty. I'm the Hennepin County Attorney. Thank you for the opportunity to express my heartfelt and wholehearted support for House File 2400. I made the decision not to argue that Marvin Haynes had missed the statutory deadline on his post-conviction petition, which allowed him to get into court and present his case. Without that threshold decision, Mr. Haynes, an innocent man, would still be in prison today. I want to be clear that while I agreed to waive that statute of limitations, he and his team presented compelling evidence that convinced us and the judge that he was innocent. Early in my term, I made the decision to waive the time bar. I didn't really know a whole lot about his case at that point, but I was committed to letting him have his chance in court. The judge granted a hearing. As this was happening, I, for the first time, read the entire file. I remember feeling sick to my stomach as I realized that he was actually innocent and that he had been in prison for over 19 years. We must be open to believing that there can be new evidence in old cases. Police officers retire and feel that they can be honest about what happened, which is what happened in this case. Our understanding of forensic evidence evolves. We become aware of the harmful practices, impacts of practices that were once believed to be effective. I can't adequately describe how it felt to read his case file and the information from the hearing and understand the randomness of Mr. Hayes' ability to get his case heard. That is the feeling that lingers with me today. We should all be extremely concerned that the statutory bar is currently so high that an innocent man needed the discretionary decision of a single county attorney to even get into the court. That is why this bill is so important. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? All right, I'm not seeing anybody. Member discussion to the bill. I just want to say thank you, Representative Frazier. Thank you to the Innocence Project for your continued work on this. It came last year, and I was a little worried it was too broad, and I appreciate that the County Attorneys Association as well spent time working together with the Innocence Project to get this language right, and also appreciative of the fact that the 45-day extension was added onto the bill. I know as someone who practices appeals, when these cases come in, it is quite common to get extensions anyway, because a lot of times they're older cases. The attorneys who handled the initial direct appeal or the prosecution are no longer there. It takes time to go through the file. So I really appreciate all of the good collaborative work that's been done with the stakeholders on this bill. Any other members wishing to speak? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Frazier. Can you walk me through and articulate how the new evidentiary standard compares to clear and convincing evidence?
All right. All right. Do we want Mr. Marquardt? Would you like to answer the question?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Hudson. The language that is being struck with this bill required that you have new evidence that makes an affirmative showing of innocence by a clear and convincing standard. There's two problems with that. One, it's an affirmative showing of innocence, which is proving a negative, proving that you didn't do something, as opposed to new evidence that in some way undermines the conviction. So that's problematic because in cases where you don't have something like DNA, it's often just impossible to make that sort of prove of a negative. The other part is that the clear and convincing standard is just very high. I mean, that's other than beyond a reasonable doubt, that's the, you know, the highest standard we have. So that the combination of those two factors really makes our current law an outlier, as Representative Frazier was describing. Most states don't make it this hard just to get over the statute of limitations. So that's kind of the core problem. In terms of the new language, the basic idea is you have to have new evidence, and it has to be truly new evidence, which means it couldn't have been discovered previously through the exercise of due diligence, which is a really meaningful limitation. Many cases get thrown out on that part. But if you have new evidence and it goes to supporting an otherwise legally cognizable claim, then you get your day in court. So you need to have basically the facts that you would need to make out the elements of a legally recognized claim, and they have to be new facts.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that clarification. It's very, very helpful. I'll just say I actually like what you're doing here, and the reason why is because, you know, often I hear arguments in the public discourse that we should not be as hard on people who find themselves on the wrong side of the justice system because of the errors that are made sometimes, and the number of people who are convicted even though they are in fact innocent. And my argument back to that has always been, well, let's fix that problem. Let's provide a way for people to not be convicted when they're innocent, or in this case, to have it overturned in an expedient fashion. So thank you, Representative Frazier.
Further member discussion? Right, closing comments, Representative Frazier.
Representative Hudson, there will be a quiz next week based on that. No, thank you all for the discussion. I think this is I know this is a good bill. It's something that needs to happen to rectify some of the issues that systemically we have in place to prevent people from having the opportunity to have the merits heard when they've been unjustly convicted. So please, let's move forward.
Right. Representative Frazier renews the motion that House File 2400, as amended, be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The last bill we have on the agenda today is House File 1718. I think I heard someone doing a train whistle over here on the side for this bill. It's a Representative Hewitt bill. And Representative Hewitt, I believe your motion is that House File 1718 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law.
Madam Chair, it is.
All right, and we also have a couple of amendments here. So first, I see the DE1 amendment. Would you like to move the DE1 amendment?
Madam Chair, I would. It would put in the bill in the position I need it in.
All right, and then you also have an A1 amendment to the DE1. So any discussion first to the A1 amendment? Representative Hewitt.
The A1 simply was a compromise with labor. And it put, again, helps the bill strong, get the bill stronger so the stakeholders felt comfortable with it.
All right. Any discussion to the A1 amendment to the DE1? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. And now you've got the DE1 amendment as amended. Any discussion to the DE1 amendment as amended? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The DE1 amendment as amended is adopted. Representative Hewitt, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And House File 1718 has been a work in progress. Many of members on my side of the aisle and also on the other side have come to me about this bill and wanted more information. This is definitely a first time for Minnesota. However, we're only one of two states that do not actively recognize railroad operational police officers as commissioned officers in their state. This poses a number of issues, which we can get into once we get down the bill. But for the most part, most states recognize them as peace officers. The reason that I got the bill, to be honest with you, was my chief brought it to me. Naturally, with a major refinery in an area and a number of new centers that need rail traffic, we are getting more and more rail traffic. The other thing is I have two major dumps in my area. And when those dumps change their dumping restrictions,
People brought their trailers out and decided not to bring them back with them and dump them in the railroad property, which led to more and more time taken by our our police officers to investigate that on an active railroad, which they did not have the control to shut down. They also had a homicide on the railroad tracks a few years ago, and our chief found frustrations with individuals that definitely had the training, definitely had the whereabouts to investigate this, but yet he could not share information with them in a police capacity. So this created some problems, and then I heard about it throughout the state. So this wasn't just here, it's there, and this would enhance our law enforcement and help us, as we, as most of us know, the rail traffic is picking up in Minnesota, and this is really something that we have to look at. So with me today, I do have some testifiers.
All right, great. And I see that one testifier is already at the table. Good job to all the testifiers today for being prompt and here. And then we've got the two others, Benjamin Black and Ishmael Cuevas, if you want to come down and be ready to testify. So I think we've got Amber Backhaus here. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Amber Backhaus. I'm with United Strategies and also serve as the Executive Director for the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association, the trade association representing four Class 1 railroads and 14 regional short line railroads who ship and deliver over 2 million carloads of commodities and goods safely and efficiently over 4,300 miles of railroad track in Minnesota. As Representative Hewitt alluded to, this bill has been over 30 years in the making. So we are incredibly grateful for him, as well as Eric Misselt at the Post Board, for helping us craft the appropriate regulatory infrastructure and the law enforcement and rail labor communities for their input, so we have a proposal that works for all parties. I want to say that the federal law is what grants there to be railroad police officers, and it's been part of railroad operations since 1849. Title 49, Section 28101, grants the authority for railroads to have police officers to protect employees, passengers, property, equipment, facility, and goods. And we are the only industry that federal authority grants that ability to. So this bill would allow railroad police at the four Class 1 railroads to become licensed peace officers in the state, giving them the authority to prevent, arrest, and investigate offenses occurring on railroad property in order to protect the tracks, cars, and equipment, rail employees and passengers, and the public at large. This authority would also make it easier for railroad police to work side by side with their public counterparts so they can provide mutual aid and share radio frequencies, a current impediment to responding to life or death situations such as suicide calls. I also want to be clear what granting this authority does not do. It does not allow railroad police to investigate company or civil violations. The overarching federal authority limits its power to criminal activities, as does the language in Subdivision 5 and the A1 Amendment. It does not entitle railroad police to any compensation or benefits from the state, and it does not make the state or any political subdivision liable for acts, errors, or omissions of the officers. That liability falls squarely on the railroad. So with me today are representatives of the Canadian Pacific Kansas City Railroad and Amtrak to provide real-world examples of how having this authority can promote public safety and alleviate the load on local law enforcement agencies. And we'd appreciate your support, and I'd be happy to stand for questions. Thank you.
And I'm not sure which one of you wants to testify next, so come on up and introduce yourself.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Ismael Cuevas, Manager of Government Affairs for Amtrak. I'm also joined by our AVP Assistant Police Chief, Jim Cook. Funding provided by the Minnesota Legislature over the past two sessions have allowed a new partnership between the state and Amtrak to increase intercity passenger rail service. Amtrak and MnDOT are in final negotiations on a contract that would provide for new train service connecting the cities, Red Wing and Winona, with Milwaukee, other Wisconsin communities, and our Chicago hub. Our network and ridership are experiencing strong growth as Americans and your constituents experience the comfort, convenience, and safety of passenger rail. We're above pre-pandemic ridership levels, prepared to break our all-time ridership record this year, and with a goal of doubling our annual ridership to 65 million by 2040. This growth would not be possible without the partnerships with states like Minnesota and others. However, our ability to grow here safely is hindered by our Amtrak police not having peace officer authority. Right now, issues regarding security and safety on our trains and our stations in Minnesota are managed by Amtrak police station and adjacent states, hindering response times. With the prospect of doubling the number of passengers at stations in Minnesota, especially at our big city station at St. Paul Union Depot, and Amtrak facilities expanding like train storage and servicing, Not having the ability to secure passengers, employees, and properties is untenable. At stations in adjacent jurisdictions, APD officers have the ability to screen passengers. APD officers also ride our trains, serving as a deterrent, enhancing security, and if necessary, may detain and charge a person committing a criminal offense. In Minnesota, we do not have this authority to protect our passengers and employees. Amtrak does not have air marshals. TSA is not a consistent fixture at our stations. Amtrak police takes care of this at our own expense, lessening the burden of local jurisdictions, but more importantly, protecting an important mode on our national transportation system. Our network in Minnesota extends 400 miles from Moorhead to La Crescent through unincorporated, large and small jurisdictions with law enforcement response and capacity varying. An emergency situation could arise anywhere along the route of our trains. Last year, Amtrak was alerted to a possible incendiary device aboard a passenger train and stopped immediately at our next community. Red Wing had an officer on duty, to respond. Train passengers were evacuated and stranded for 7 hours while we waited for first responders from adjacent agencies and the FBI to respond from far away at St. Paul. We thank Red Wing for their help, but could have responded more quickly and effectively with sworn officers nearby. Amtrak has K-9 units trained in bomb detection and team skilled in managing the unique characteristics and environment inside a passenger train. In addition, Amtrak regularly works with local law enforcement through our network to provide additional training, such as RailSafe, to enhance the response to passenger train emergencies with us. Thank you, and I would be happy to take any questions after.
All right, and looks like you have one more testifier. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the committee. My name is Ben Black. I am the district commander of CPKC's Railroad Police Department, covering the Illinois, Minnesota, and North Dakota territory, and I am a resident of Wyoming, Minnesota. Thank you very much for allowing me the opportunity to discuss why the Canadian Pacific Kansas City supports 1718. Safety is a core principle at CPKC and the foundation of everything that we do. Railroad police exist to safeguard public safety along the tracks and operations of the railroad. We protect the railroad's infrastructure and serve an important role in securing North America's supply chain. Because the railroad is private property and traverses through multiple jurisdictions, other police agencies have limited capability to enforce the law across the railroad system. Additionally, policing the railroad environment requires a deep understanding of railroad safety and operations, knowledge that is not found within other police agencies. CPKC's network spans 17 states, with Minnesota right at the heart of our northern network. We operate in every state and province that borders Minnesota. In every one of these jurisdictions, we are fully commissioned police officers by that state and empowered to enforce the law, but not in Minnesota. Why does it matter that Minnesota does not have this important layer of railroad safety and security? I'll give you a local example here. All too real from Maple Lake, Minnesota, from the end of 2023. We investigated multiple incidents over a couple of months of a person intentionally severing railroad signal wires in an attempt to disrupt the signaling systems. In the end, this investigation drew resources from the local sheriff's department to investigate and bring the case to the court. This tied up that local agency for quite a bit and lengthened the entire process. It is work like this that protects not only the public, but also ensures that the railroad employees have a safer workplace. CPKC police officers and their actions make our railroads a safer environment. Interestingly enough, there is a time when railroad police had the power in Minnesota to take action in these situations. Up until 1977, railroad police were considered police officers in Minnesota. Our ability to protect the railroad property and employees was lost only by an oversight when the Minnesota Post Board was formed. The legislation that created it effectively left out railroad police from having authority due to the language granting that authority only to those officers of a political subdivision or a state agency. Indeed, both the Minnesota Law Enforcement Memorial Association and the National Law Enforcement Memorial honor the duty and sacrifice of railroad police in Minnesota's history, in that they recognize railroad detective Bruce Palmer, who was shot and killed in the line of duty in May of 1929 in Proctor, Minnesota. Today, myself and our officers based in this state do our best to liaise with your community first responders. But in times of emergency, we cannot step up and respond like they can to keep the railroad safe and assist in our keeping our neighbors safe. In 2023 alone, my officers in Minnesota fielded approximately 3,200 calls for service that came from our employees and members of the public. This is why communities from across CPKC's network in Minnesota have voiced their support for 1718. From La Crescent to Proctor Police, Buffalo to Hastings, Columbia Heights, the City of Minneapolis, Minneapolis Park Police, as well as sheriffs from Kitson County down to Houston County, the police chief of Winona has stated, quote, "Our department has had the opportunity to work directly with the railroad police and have found them to be extremely courteous, professional, and well-trained. As a local law enforcement agency, we would also welcome the additional resources of the Railroad Police to assist us with police response and equipment, end quote. Thank you, committee, for your time. CPKC believes that the time has come for Minnesota to enhance railroad safety. Please support House File 1718.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony. Do we have any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? I'm not seeing any, so we can move on now to member discussion. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Representative Hewitt. I'm actually a co-author on this bill. When I first saw it, when it was brought to me, made a lot of sense. The only heartburn I'm having on this is the post board's authority to revoke for any reason. Can we either talk offline about fixing that, because that precedent is a little, it goes a little far, or could I get some clarification as to why that's in there?
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Ingen, we need it in there. These people will become Minnesota licensed peace officers. They now have to meet that standard. So that's actually what the holdup has been all these years, is that yes, our board does have, the post board does have that control, but they're willing to take it. They knew that when they came to me on the bill. That was a deal that we had to work with the post board. That's why this has taken so long. They all do. Right now, they all will, and they are not afraid of that. They feel their professionalism is there, and that's what we have to do. And so, because we can't have one guy from Rosemount at this level and them at another level. They have to be equal, and that brings the respect in the room. And after working with law enforcement a lot over these last 2 years, that they always, the post board is their standard. Now, they might not agree with everything, but the post board is a standard, and I believe we have to keep it there. So thank you for that question. Great question.
Yes. Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Representative Hewitt, for bringing this bill forward. And I do have to say you look very sharp today in that jacket. So.
Oh.
Wow. So.
Winning. Today.
Winning. Yes.
You're twinning today.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
But this brings a lot of common sense. We've seen it in incidents. You described one really good in Rosemont, and that sharing of information between law enforcement. I understand the post part. I'm glad post was able to work through it. We got the support of all our police chiefs and sheriffs, and I just want to say thank you for bringing this forward.
Lee Novotny.
Just one quick question for you, Chair. Has this been to transportation, or is it going to transportation?
The next stop is judiciary, and then I don't know about transportation. I'm seeing, yeah, go ahead, Representative Hewitt.
Chair and Lee Novotny, I ran it by our chair, and they don't feel they have to see it. Unless you think it should be, I mean, we can talk about
it. Well, Representative Novotny.
Just a question. And as you're aware, I am, I think, the number two signer on this bill. I really appreciate the changes that were made in the amendment. And just to clarify for the people that are out watching, Representative Hewitt, railroad police would not be involved in, they would not be primary in an accident involving the train.
Representative Hewitt.
I'm looking right at the guy here now, and I don't believe that. I believe it's the same first response system that we have in place. They would be brought in, right?
Yeah, Mr. Sorry. Black. Man. Or Commander Black.
Oh, yeah, you're up.
Go ahead.
We would be first responder. We would be primary only to liaison with the public agency for the, and I think if I may, I believe you're probably asking for reporting purposes. We are not a public reporting entity. So we would still require a public agency to provide the crash report so that there's no third-party conflict.
Okay. And I just want to get that off of it. Thank you, Chair. As the son of a railroad train car accident victim, I just want to make sure that the public understands that, the part of the bill, that the railroad would not be in charge of investigating the accidents at crossings and things like that. Representative Hewitt Yalishel mentioned a death on the railroad right away. They would respond, but they would not be primary in that death investigation, be it a, whatever the cause of the death, be it suicide or homicide or accidental or natural. And the biggest thing that appealed to me in this bill is we have the saying in law enforcement, you catch them, you clean them. This helps with that. If railroad police comes across a violation right now where they have to deal with someone, someone's going to be going to jail or there's evidence, If they have to call the local agency, well, that just creates that many more people and the evidence that'll have to be called when it comes to, if it goes to court. If they don't have to be involved, we don't need to involve two people when one person can do it, and it'll save the locals a lot of time that way. So I really thank the local PDs down in your area, Representative Hewitt, that pushed this. So I recommend a yes.
Yeah, thank you. And I just want to say thank you to all the stakeholders for all your years and years and years of work on this and all the collaboration now that's here to get this bill in the right shape. So very much appreciate it. A good lobbyist once told me never celebrate till the ink is dry. So, but I'm hoping we can get it done this year. Closing comments, Representative Hewitt.
Great bill. Please support it.
All right. Representative Hewitt renews the motion that House File 1718, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Members, that concludes today's agenda, and we will see you tomorrow. I'm apologizing in advance for a Friday hearing, but we will see you tomorrow. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.